Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. What began as a police sting operation at a day spa in Jupiter, Florida, has ripped the cover off what investigators say is a human trafficking sex ring. Here's Palm Beach County State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg yesterday.
The Jupiter Police Department gave us case filing packets stemming from their prostitution sting. After review by our intake prosecutors, we are charging 25 individuals with soliciting another to commit prostitution.
Among those charged for soliciting prostitution, Robert Kraft, the billionaire owner of the New England Patriots. Police say they have videotape of him and others paying for and receiving sexual services at the Orchids of Asia Spa in Jupiter. Kraft denies he did anything illegal. The most disturbing part of this story are the allegations that the sex workers were sexual slaves linked to a human trafficking ring, and that spas like this are in communities across the country. This hour on Point, sex trafficking, its victims hidden in plain sight. Join us. What do you make of the news of Robert Kraft soliciting prostitution? What do you make of allegations of human sex trafficking? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from West Palm Beach, Florida, is Olivia Hitchcock. She's a reporter for the Palm Beach Post. She's been covering the sex trafficking ring in Florida, and you can find a link to her reporting on the story at onpointradio.org. It's great to have you, Olivia Hitchcock. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So bring us up to date. What did we learn yesterday from State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg about this case?
Yes. So yesterday, State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg held a press conference in which he announced the formal filing of charges against Robert Kraft among 25 men who are facing charges as part of this sting. So that means that Kraft has formally been charged with soliciting a prostitute, and that would be two counts of that.
Right. And so what do we know about where this case goes? First of all, let's focus on Robert Kraft. This case against him, will he face arrest?
No, not necessarily. This is because it is a first-degree misdemeanor charge. That means that this is something his attorney, who I'm sure he will have one, or if he doesn't already, but that's something that his attorney would be able to handle with the state attorney's office. Because his main residence is not in Palm Beach County or in Florida, he would be able to kind of handle this through his attorneys. So no, it's
because
not
it's
likely
a,
that he will.
Right. So because it's a second-degree misdemeanor, he couldn't be extradited from Massachusetts to Florida, for example.
Correct. And it is a first-degree misdemeanor, actually, that they ended up formally charging him with.
First-degree.
Yeah, so a little bit higher jail time that in theory he could be facing, but it is unlikely that he or others will actually serve.
And what do we know about when and how many times Mr. Kraft visited the spa, according to law enforcement officials?
Yes. So Jupiter police were able to get a warrant, and they installed surveillance cameras. And for 5 days, they had these cameras going in the massage rooms. And Mr. Kraft was seen twice in these videos, we're told, paying for sex acts from the women who work there.
So, Olivia, I want to play a little bit of tape. This is from a press conference on Saturday. Chief of Police Daniel Kerr confirming to Channel 5's Michael Williams that Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, was one of the people charged with soliciting prostitution.
Yes, sir. He is one of the individuals.
Can you please name who he is?
That would be Mr. Robert Kraft.
Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots?
Yes, sir.
And what is he being charged with?
He's being charged with the same offenses as the others, and that is soliciting another to commit prostitution.
And how many accounts may he face?
Right now we have two different visits.
So, Olivia, give us a sense of what we know about how Robert Kraft has responded.
He denies everything. And I believe the language his attorney or his spokesperson used was categorically denies. So at this point, yeah, it's a deny from him.
Right. So investigators believe that this is connected to a human trafficking ring involving Chinese national. Has anyone been charged with human trafficking yet in this case?
No, at this point, no one faces human trafficking charges. Some of the spa owners and managers have been charged with, they call it, maintaining a house of ill fame. And law enforcement agencies alluded that there may be human trafficking charges filed down the line. But again, like you said, at this point, no one is facing human trafficking charges.
I see. And what do investigators say about the employees, the female sex workers in the day spa in Jupiter? What do we know about the conditions they were living in and working in?
Yes. So in the Jupiter case, a Florida Department of Health inspector came and did what was a routine inspection in November and saw there were beds, a dresser, hot plates, and I mean, it was clear that people were living there. So from our understanding of the situation at this point, and of course they're not telling us very much about the victims, but it does sound like these women were working incredibly long days and forced to perform these sex acts on men, and they lived at the spa, actually, as well. And what we heard from Martin County Sheriff's authorities earlier in the investigation was that these women often come to the United States told that they're going to have a better life, they're going to have actual employment, whether that be as masseuses or whatever else they're told. But in reality, they come into the United States, their passports are taken, they don't have opportunities to work and earn their own money, and they're forced to work in these kind of spa environments.
Right. And Olivia, do we have any idea yet if any of these sex workers or these sex slaves, if you will, are cooperating with investigators?
In the Jupiter case, yes. They have identified one woman who they categorize as being trafficked to the United States. And yes, she is cooperating with investigators from our understanding.
I see. Now, you mentioned the Jupiter case, and my understanding is, along with that case, this case is part of a sprawling investigation of massage parlors across Florida, right? Can you tell us a little bit about,
yes,
just about how extensive this investigation is?
Yes, absolutely. So the investigation, from our understanding, started in Martin County, which is the county north of Palm Beach. And they kind of traced this operation and saw that it's in all up and down the east coast of Florida, as well going over to the Orlando area. And this larger human trafficking and prostitution ring is said to have ties to New York and back to China. At this point, it's hard to grasp really how wide and how involved this ring is.
But according to investigators, it sounds like it's pretty wide and pretty extensive. Olivia Hitchcock, reporter for the Palm Beach Post, who's been covering the sex trafficking ring in Florida. You can find a link to her story headline, State Attorney Announces 25 Prostitution Arrests, Including Patriots Owner Robert Kraft, at our website, onpointradio.org. Olivia, I'm going to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And let me introduce now, from Washington, D.C., Robert Houston. He's a former FBI special agent who specialized in counterterrorism and transnational organized crime. He's the co-founder of Presidium Partners, an intelligence-driven advocacy group fighting human trafficking globally. And Bob Houston, thanks for joining us. It's really good to have you.
Hello, Anthony. Thanks for having me on.
So how common is this kind of operation that we're hearing described, that Olivia did such a good job describing down there in Florida?
I think Olivia's description was right on. The what we refer to as the illicit massage industry is a $3 billion transnational organized crime enterprise that is comprised of a number of smaller enterprises, a number of smaller networks. The public manifestation of that, or the public-facing piece of that, are 9,000 to 10,000 of these storefront illicit massage businesses across the country, like the ones in Jupiter and those up in the Vero Beach area that were the subject of the Florida police activity recently.
So 9,000 to 10,000 operations across the country, pretty much in all 50 states?
Definitely in all 50 states. They are in big cities. They're in the suburbs, medium-sized cities, small towns. The largest number is in California, but Florida, Texas, New York, they round out the top four. Several thousand in California and hundreds in the other states.
And roughly, what are the numbers of folks who are swept into these operations or imprisoned essentially in these operations?
Sure. It's hard to know exactly. Our research indicates there are usually 3 to 4 victim workers, which is how we refer to the women that are trafficked into these places, 3 to 4 victim workers at each location. So if you just do the math there, you're looking somewhere between 30 and 40,000 at any given time. The reason that that may not be a hard number is we also see indications that some of the victim workers in illicit massage businesses are also moved back and forth between other types of exploitation, such as hotel brothels, apartment brothels. So the actual number may very well be higher.
Mm. And typically, what are the conditions like for these folks who you refer to as victim workers, and understandably so? What are they dealing with in terms of their living condition and the terms of their work, their employment?
Right. The starting point in understanding this is a term called debt bondage, that each of these victim workers who has been brought to the United States, and they almost all come from 4 Asian countries, that they arrive owing some amount of money, usually between $40,000 and $60,000. So there's coercion involved. They were brought here fraudulently, usually for fraudulent reasons. And they begin their time in the United States owing $40,000 to $60,000. And then the conditions were much as Olivia described there at the top of the hour.
Bob, I'm going to jump in because we're up against a break, but we're going to come back and ask you to continue that thought. We're discussing the sex trafficking ring in Florida and beyond, which has ensnared some prominent people, including Patriots owner Robert Kraft. Do you know just how widespread these so-called illicit massage businesses are? They could be linked to human trafficking. Do you know one, if one is in your community? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking about the sex trafficking ring in Florida and beyond, Robert Kraft's arrest for soliciting prostitution, and the victim sex workers who are at the center of this very disturbing story. On Megyn Kelly Today, last April, a young woman named Jessica, who asked to keep her last name anonymous, spoke about her experience of being trafficked after she ran away from home at the age of 15.
It happens faster than you can imagine. It's just so much manipulation. And at one point you start believing that this is, you know, what you're meant to do and that it's not necessarily a bad thing. And then you just shut down mentally and emotionally and you just kind of go through the motions and you don't you don't really think about anything else, just trying to survive.
In a moment, listeners, we're going to be talking to a woman who was sex trafficked when she was younger. She's a sex trafficking survivor. I'm talking to former FBI Special Agent Bob Houston. He's the co-founder of Presidium Partners, an intelligence-driven advocacy group fighting human trafficking globally. And Bob, before the break, you were just explaining sort of how extensive this is in terms of the numbers of victims that get swept up into this.
Yes, 30 to 40,000 at any given time in illicit massage businesses in the United States, all owing some sort of a debt bondage to their traffickers. You were asking about the conditions on site, and they are very much as was described in Florida by Olivia at the top of the hour. Oftentimes, the women are living on site. Oftentimes, they're not allowed to leave the location. They service customers without a choice. Whenever the establishment is open, there are places in the country where these IMBs, illicit massage businesses, are open 24/7. Some others have hours that go late into the evening and then shut down for a period of time. And the conditions are deplorable. The victim workers retain very little, if any, of the money that is paid by the buyers to the establishment, and thus are very seldom able to pay off this bondage debt that they owe.
Interesting. I want to talk a little bit about the law enforcement response to this. With regard to the case in Jupiter, Florida, it's focused on the Johns, including Robert Kraft. So clearly this is part of an effort to publicly shame these folks for going into these massage parlors and taking advantage of the services being offered. Is that approach effective? Is that part of an effective solution to this?
It can be part of an effective solution. There are three groups of people impacted when law enforcement conducts an investigation of one of these places. The buyers, as you pointed out, and oftentimes they are charged with a soliciting type offense, which is a misdemeanor under state law, though there are some opportunities under federal law for more significant charges if the buyer knew that the person was trafficked or was likely to have been trafficked. So you have the buyers. You also have the victim workers. Law enforcement has come a long way in the last few years in treating them as victims as opposed to prostitutes, which is how they typically were handled in the past. And usually they're referred to some sort of social service agency or a non-governmental agency that can provide culturally appropriate care. The third group, though, is the owners, operators, facilitators, recruiters, the traffickers of the victim workers. And there have been several prosecutions around the country that have focused on that group. And we advocate that approaching this as organized crime in the same way you would approach a large, say, drug trafficking organization or any sort of other organized crime enterprise is the way to go here as well and look at how these networks are connected, how the owners, operators, and facilitators move their victim workers, their product, if you will, around, how they recruit them overseas, how they move the money, and explore the other aspects of organized crime associated with the industry.
Wow. Well, I want to get into all of that going forward. Listeners, we're talking about sex trafficking, and this is all inspired by this conversation is prompted by this really startling story out of Jupiter, Florida, where Robert Kraft was charged with soliciting prostitution. And there are allegations down there that this is all connected to an extensive human trafficking ring. What do you make of this? What are your questions? And I want to introduce now from Dallas, Texas, Rebecca Charleston. She is a sex trafficking survivor who now works as a consultant with the National Criminal Justice Training Center and as an advocate for victims of sexual exploitation at as the executive director of Valiant Hearts. Rebecca Charleston, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Very nice to meet you, Anthony.
It's good to meet you. Do you mind telling us a little bit about your story? How did you end up in a situation where you were trafficked?
Sure. I had a couple of significant life events as a child. I had a family member commit suicide. I was raped at the age of 14, and I wound up running away from home at the age of 17 because I felt like I had no one to connect to, and I blamed myself, and I never told anyone the things that had happened to me. And so I was walking around with a lot of pain and unresolved trauma, and within about a year's time, I ran away. I'm sorry. I started using drugs to cope with all that pain as a 15-year-old. And then at 17, I ran away from home, and it was only a few months of living on the street, homeless, stealing food in order to eat every day, that I met my first trafficker, and he seemed like this really great guy, and he was very cute, and I thought he was going to be my boyfriend, and I thought he was going to get me out of the negative situation that I was living in. And it wasn't until the second day that I would realize what his dreams were going to cost me in the form of my dignity and my body. And I was forced to go out on the track on Harry Hines Boulevard in Dallas, and I was told exactly how to ask people if they wanted to have sex with me and exactly how much money I had to charge them. And Anthony, it was like my entire world flipped upside down on top of me. You know, I had no idea what to do. I thought, if I run, I'm going to get murdered and chopped up in little pieces. And so I stayed and I obeyed them. And that one day turned into the next 10 years of my life. I was traded from one trafficker to another. I wasn't able to escape until federal authorities finally became involved.
Wow. And Rebecca, do I understand it correctly? You also worked in brothels as well, legalized brothels. Is that right?
That is correct. Out of my trafficking experience, the victimization I experienced, every single level of what sex trafficking and prostitution looks like in America. I met both of my traffickers in strip clubs. I love to highlight that because when we look at the overarching issues here, we're talking about sex trafficking, massage parlors, pornography, dancing in strip clubs, prostitution. They're all separate, distinct issues, but they're so inextricably linked that you cannot have one without the other. And so I have been sold on the streets. I have been sold in the suites, as they say, in Las Vegas. I have been sold in brothels. I've been sold in licensed brothels in Las Vegas. And after hearing Robert and Olivia, it sounds just like the massage parlors. There's really, it sounds like no difference hardly between a massage parlor and a licensed brothel in Nevada.
So, Bob Houston, I want to come back to you. Listening to Rebecca's story there, she described her situation at a certain point in her life being young, homeless, drug addicted, vulnerable. Is that a profile that explains how so many people can end up in a situation like this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is right on point. In addition, with the massage, the illicit massage businesses, we have the problem that the victim workers also usually do not speak English. So they're from a foreign place. They've not experienced American culture at all. They've been taught that that American authorities, that law enforcement may be corrupt. They may be the bad guys themselves, and you shouldn't speak with them. So you have some additional cultural factors on top of it. Imagine being in a place where you had no comprehension of the language at all. You wouldn't even know how to dial 911, for example, even if you wanted to. So you have that on top of it. But the profile that Rebecca describes is exactly right: young, vulnerable, recruited by those who would provide promises of a much better life that turns out to be very different than anticipated.
Yeah, Rebecca, I'd like to sort of get your response to what we're reading about and hearing about in Jupiter, Florida. What have you been thinking about when you think about these young victims, these young sex worker victims, essentially, who may have much in common with your situation, but add the fact that they're in a foreign country and don't speak the language? What are you thinking about when you look at that story?
Well, I'm so excited that you guys are portraying both international human trafficking and what it looks like on domestic American soil, because it can be vastly different, but the two do relate. And the fact that I consider myself lucky after all the arrests, all the beatings, all the violent abuse that I have endured, I consider myself lucky because I did have a family that I could have reached out to. My parents have been married 55 years. I'm the youngest of six kids. And I had someone. I just chose not to. And that's what I always tell people. What about someone that doesn't have anyone in their life that they could reach out to for help? Or it's possibly their families that are even exploiting them. Or like these women in this case, where they're from another country and don't even speak the language. I mean, I think it clearly makes the case that sex trafficking is ubiquitous in America, that there's not a community that is unaffected by it, and that we have to go after the demand that women are not public sexual property, and people like Robert Kraft that have power and control should not be allowed to buy vulnerable, marginalized women for their own gratification.
Well, boy, that's a huge point, and I want to come back to that and talk about that with you, Bob Houston. But we've got a lot of folks on the phones right now who want to get in on this conversation. So let's go to some of them. Lisa is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Lisa, you're on the air. It's good to have you. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for taking my call. Rebecca brings up a point I think about all the time, that we need to focus on the demands in a macro way. Like, boys will be boys, like this whole thing that it's just natural for men to want to purchase something to masturbate into is just not, this is the thing that needs to have more education in schools. And I also am all for the John School idea, where when men are arrested for purchasing sex, they're educated and there's people like Rebecca who are sharing their stories. And this has worked in places like San Francisco and in, I believe, Lowell, Massachusetts.
All right, Lisa, thanks so much for that. I appreciate it. Bob Houston, John Schools, other ideas? What do you think of what our caller Lisa was talking about?
Right. Many times, depending on the state, a person caught in the situation that Robert Kraft is in, where they're charged for the first time with a soliciting offense, have to go to an education program referred to as a John School. And there they learn about the impact of their actions, and they learn about the trafficking that occurs in the industry. But I think beyond just the John Schools, the education piece is very important. That's one reason I'm glad you're covering this topic on the show. There has been for too long a lack of understanding, and some of it I think is a willful blindness, but about the condition in the illicit massage businesses in particular, and the fact that it is trafficking. They're all around us in our communities, and in some cases we've taken that for with a grain of salt. There are a couple of them near where my kids do sports here in the D.C. suburbs, and they're all around people's neighborhoods near where people work. And we've come to sort of accept that, and that's wrong. It's no longer acceptable. And part of the way to get at that is to educate the public, educate the authorities in some cases about the trafficking that occurs in these situations.
I want to read a comment that we got on our listener Facebook page. Jacob Evans writes, prostitution is one thing. Sex work can be legitimate work. I hope the discussion makes the distinction between it and sex trafficking, which is simple slavery. Rebecca, I want to come to you on that. I actually want to get response from both of you. But does our listener make a point that there needs to be a distinction between legitimate sex work and sex trafficking?
I'm going to just make two quick points. I want everyone, every listener, to think about Robert Kraft, a billionaire, walking into the facade of a seedy massage parlor to get a massage. I mean, I know if I want to get a massage, I'm going to go to a hotel chain or a legitimate massage therapist. I mean, the idea of him walking in there and not looking for sexual services is ludicrous. And to respond to Jacob, I can appreciate his opinion, but I could not disagree more. I think that the term sex work is a euphemism. I think sex is something beautiful that should happen between two consenting parties, and that when you introduce an influencer as powerful as money into the picture, that consent is no longer there. And I think that prostitution in its entirety is gender-based violence. Right now, there's a TMZ posted an article actually soliciting Robert Kraft to travel interstate lines to go all the way to Nevada, which violates the federal law, the Mann Act, to solicit prostitutes in their legal brothels.
Interesting.
Which is horrendous.
Yeah. Bob Houston, I'd love to give your response as well to this comment that I read from Jacob from Facebook.
I thought Rebecca's response was right on, but let me add one thing. I'll answer this way. There was a prosecution in Minneapolis by federal authorities over the last 2 years. A trial occurred in late 2018 involving a Thai sex trafficking network. They charged 39 people. And out of that case came something really interesting, and I think it's the first time it was documented in a court of law, and that is that the debt bondage of the victim workers was sold between different parties. In other words, one trafficker or one operator could sell the debt bondage to another trafficker, and then that victim worker went to that trafficker, much as Rebecca described one pimp taking her from another pimp. We have what clearly looks like modern-day slavery, has all of the aspects of that. And that's one way I would answer the question of can this be legitimate? If you look at how the victim workers are treated as essentially a product by the traffickers, there really can only be one answer, and that it is clearly trafficking of women who have no choice in the matter.
Really interesting. Here's another comment from our Facebook page. Susan Morris Strickland writes, the thing that blew my mind was the comments about this. Many were saying things like, what he does in his private life is his own business. This attitude is partly why this horrible crime is a multi-billion dollar business. Listeners, we're talking about sex trafficking ring. This is prompted by the story, Robert Kraft being charged with soliciting prostitution in Florida. What do you make of this? What's the solution? How do we protect these victim workers? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about sex trafficking and the huge bust at massage parlors in Florida, including charges against Robert Kraft. You can join the conversation. What can be done to protect women being trafficked to our country and sold as sex workers? I'm talking to former FBI Special Agent Bob Houston. He's the co-founder of Presidium Partners, an intelligence-driven advocacy group fighting human trafficking globally. Also with us is Rebecca Charleston, a sex trafficking survivor who now works as a consultant with the National Criminal Justice Training Center as an advocate for victims of sexual exploitation. And we're taking your calls, and let's go right to one right now. Jenny is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jenny, thanks for joining us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment about the focus on En Demand and John School. I am a scholar and an activist, and we have very good data that show that the decriminalization of sex work helps to mitigate the abuses in the sex industry. And I also think there's a bit of a conflation here going on with sex trafficking and sex work, and I'm wondering why organizations that represent migrant sex workers, migrant people in the sex industry aren't being represented in this conversation.
Well, it's a good question, Jenny, but let me put this first question to Bob Houston about this idea of decriminalizing sex work would be one good way to mitigate against the kind of sex slavery that we're talking about. Do you agree with that, Bob?
I'm not an expert in the decriminalization movement, but from what I've seen in other locations where it's been tried, mainly overseas, in Europe, New Zealand has experimented with it as well. They have not reported seeing a decrease in trafficking. It usually means that there is less of an emphasis on charging buyers. And there also may be then, because they view it as no longer criminal, less of a interest in or emphasis on looking at the organized crime aspects of it. That allows then the criminal enterprises more freedom to actually operate. And I think that's what they've seen in those locations.
Yeah. And Rebecca, what's your point of view on this, the caller's point about decriminalization?
I definitely think women should not be arrested for prostitution. I think that women that are either forced or they do it out of desperation or financial need enter prostitution, I believe that they need services and assistance and help in finding something else to do. I don't think they should be criminalized with a record. I can say I've been arrested 10 times. I have a federal felony on my jacket, and how difficult it has been, even after training tens of thousands of law enforcement and getting a bachelor's and master's degree and graduating summa cum laude, it still doesn't matter. I still can't volunteer at my son's school because I don't want to do a background check. I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to embarrass my son. So I think it gives, I think that by criminalizing prostitution, that we are even further damaging victimized people.
Let's go to Bob, who is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for the call.
Hello. My question is, where's the INS in all this? They're supposedly all over stopping trafficking, and where are they? And why are they so conspicuously absent?
Good question. Bob Houston, do you have an answer for Bob in Omaha?
Yes, great question. The Department of Homeland Security is involved in a number of investigations around the country regarding trafficking into the illicit massage industry. Nearly all of the victim workers who came into the United States, or I should say most of them, came in legally initially. Now, they may have fraudulently obtained their visas, but they came on B-1 or B-2 visas and then overstayed those visas. So they are unlawfully present. However, again, just back to the answer that Rebecca gave to the last question, and I wanted to be clear with that as well, that that I'm also not in favor of pressing criminal charges against the victim workers who are involved in the industry. But what you also see is then a situation when they are rescued from these situations. Many of them are illegally present in the United States. And at that point, decisions have to be made as to what happens. And the approach that we have moved to these days is not to immediately deport them, but to provide them services as trafficking victims. And in fact, in some cases, there is the ability for them to apply then for visas to stay in the United States. But on the front end of this is where we see a real problem, in that how do they get visas to come to the United States in the first place? And that usually happens through a process that the traffickers run overseas, where they make the victim workers look like good risks to receive a visa to come to the United States. And they do that through fraudulent means. They will arrange marriages for the victim worker overseas. They will arrange false employment. They will put money in their bank account. So when they come to apply for a visa at a U.S. embassy or consulate, they might look like a pretty good risk to the consular officer who has to make the decision on whether to issue the visa, a good risk of returning to the country from which they came after their visit to the United States. And it's a really excellent point, and we've tried to emphasize that there needs to be more of a look on that side, more of an emphasis placed there on screening out potential victims in that process before they even get to the United States.
Let's take another call. Cheryl is calling from Warren, Ohio. Cheryl, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I am a city councilwoman in the city of Warren, Ohio. At one time, we were known as the massage parlor capital of Ohio. Hmm. We had 10 parlors in our city, and I spearheaded the closing of 8 of those massage parlors in 2012 with the help of some community organizers. We were told by city administrators that we could not close these parlors down constitutionally, so we had to reach out to the Attorney General's office, who came into our city and assisted us in closing these parlors down. Now, an informant told us that there was human trafficking going on in these parlors, and as a result, I personally was threatened. I was harassed by some of our local police officers, but the purpose of my call really is to urge other politicians in other cities, do not be afraid. Close down these human trafficking parlors in your communities.
Cheryl, thanks so much for that call. Rebecca Charleston, my guess is you would agree with what we just heard from Cheryl?
Most definitely, Anthony. I also want to bring light to another case that was just uncovered in Dallas of massage parlors where the owners were laundering. They laundered allegedly $6.5 million through casinos that are close to Texas. So, I mean, these aren't isolated incidents. They're taking place across the country. And I just want to highlight for those listeners out there that, you know, think that sex work is a legitimate thing and that it's consenting adults. But as someone that was in it for more than 10 years, I can say that daily realities are horrendous of what I face. I can't tell you how many grown men I have been in fist fights with, running out of hotel rooms with my clothes in my hand, getting dressed in the stairwell because I just maced him as he tried to violently rape me. How many times I found guns in hotel rooms of customers? How many women I know that have been murdered by customers or by their pimps? There's nothing safe. There's nothing glamorous about it.
Rebecca, how did you get out of the situation? How did you free yourself from this, from this terrible cycle of violence and a really difficult situation? How did you get out of it?
You know, unfortunately for me, it was really going to federal prison really helped me. That was the first time I had more than a year of sleep every day. I ate 3 meals a day. I didn't have people touching my body that I didn't want touching me. And while I still went back to him when I got out, I believed all the lies he told me every day on the phone while I was serving time for him. It was in 2009 that he turned himself in on the same charge that I knew I had 24 months to run and hide and change my identity before he hunted me down and killed me.
What a story, Rebecca. Let's take another call. Sarah is calling from Peoria, Illinois. Sarah, you're on the air. Good to have you. Thanks.
Thank you for taking my call. I'll try and keep this brief. I think people suffer from the idea that it can't happen here. I'm in central Illinois, and we have I-55, which runs from Chicago, which is an international airport, down to St. Louis. And it's very low population in certain areas of central Illinois, and it's real easy for some guy to just rent the Jones house, and then he can put the people in it. And I was part of a women's organization at one point that helped raise money to furnish, get women medical care and education who were picked up, and they were trying to help them. So cornfields do not protect you, neither do soybean fields. It can happen here.
It can happen here. Sarah, thanks so much for that call. Bob Houston, I'd love you to comment on that. And to the previous caller who was the city councilwoman who was making the case about the challenge of closing these massage parlors down in some cases because of constitutional concerns. I mean, does this resonate with you? Are these some of the challenges that communities face out there?
Sure. Well, to the last caller, yes, these operations are everywhere, including in rural America. There certainly are more in larger metropolitan areas, but no place is immune. And the traffickers are very good about moving victim workers from one place to another. We see oftentimes that victim workers may be in a particular city or location for a couple of weeks or a couple of months and then are moved elsewhere. And they may be moved from a big city to a more rural location to work for a period of time. And that's a fairly common practice. To the prior caller, I think it was Cheryl in Ohio, great work. That's all I have to say there. I mean, really great work. We need community activists around the country to take a look at what's happening in their own communities and then look at solutions that have worked elsewhere. There are times when I wouldn't call it a constitutional issue, but there are times when law enforcement, because either resources or because their local municipal or state laws are not appropriate to be used for criminal enforcement in these situations, that may not be the best option. And in those situations, there are other approaches. You see, in some communities, civil actions for nuisance type violations or for zoning code violations. Most places, people are not supposed to be living at businesses, for example. That's illegal. It may not bring criminal charges, but it may be enough to close down a storefront operation. There are landlords in places who've been approached and said and told what is happening in these strip malls that they own. And in some cases, they've denied knowing about it. In other cases, there's some question as to whether they really did or not, but they did not want that publicity. And they've taken action to evict IMBs from those locations. So community activism is huge here. This is not something that while we do advocate that law enforcement should take a hard look at this writ large as organized crime, it's not a law enforcement-only solution. There are a number of things that people who are concerned around the country can do in their own communities.
What about new laws? Rebecca, let me ask you this. Eric McLeish, he's a Boston attorney who represents victims of sexual abuse. He's done it for the last 25 years. He wrote in the Boston Globe today, "Unfortunately, the law does not allow Johns to be charged with aiding and abetting human trafficking. It's time that it did." Do you agree with that? Is that the kind of new law that would help this situation in your view?
I think in order to truly end this problem, to truly end sexual exploitation, that we have to go after the demand. I think so many people love to say that prostitution is the world's oldest profession, and what that means to me is that it's actually the world's oldest form of oppression and violence against women. And I think that it's got to be changed. I think that we need new laws on the books in order to go after demand. There's some states like Washington State that are leading the charge. There's been CEASE Networks, which is an acronym, C-E-A-S-E. They were very active with Swanee Hunt. And at doing demand tactics, because it's simple economics. If we keep going after the supply, which is the victimized party, and we're slapping them with criminal records, and then we expect them somehow to get out and do something different, and all we're doing is looking at the men and going, oh, boys will be boys. They're fine. Let's not do anything to them. There's no justice in that.
Bob Houston, a thought from you on what could happen legislatively in terms of new laws to go after this problem.
I thought the federal government did a really good job with the changes in, I believe it was 2015, to the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, because that does in fact allow federal prosecutors to charge buyers with trafficking offenses in some situations. It's hit or miss by, as Rebecca pointed out, by state. Some states, such as Washington State, are forward-leaning on it. Massachusetts has a very good human trafficking law, although I'm not sure how well that would let buyers be charged as actual traffickers. But I do concur that the demand side of the equation, the buying side, needs to be addressed. And the other piece of it, again, not to focus on the victim workers, but to focus on those who are owning and operating the establishments and essentially owning the victim workers, they need to be looked at as transnational organized crime. We need to be looking at their networks. We need to be looking at their money and how it moves. And that approach, I think, is one that we have yet to do, at least at a national level.
Well, a lot of good ideas, a lot of important stuff to think about in this hour. Bob Houston, former FBI special agent, co-founder of Presidium Partners. That's an intelligence-driven advocacy group fighting human trafficking globally. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Rebecca Charleston, she's a sex trafficking survivor who now works as a consultant with the National Criminal Justice Training Center as an advocate for victims of sexual exploitation at Valiant Hearts. Rebecca Charleston, thank you so much as well, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Our program is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardinsky, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from Matt Hoish, Asil Khabib, David Marino, and Alex Pena. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Psst. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.